Tantal Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Dark Tomorrow by Helen Harper. Narrated by Saskia Malveld. Chapter 1. Smoking Ruins. The smart thing to do would be to hightail it out of London before the Cuckoo's demons decide to finish what they started. As I slink from one shadowy street corner to another, I know I'm not the only person who's keeping their head down. The city is in virtual lockdown, and everyone, humans and tribers included, is running scared. I imagine that the only ones who are sitting with their feet up and looking happy are the demons themselves. The others, even those who hated the vampire families with a passion, are terrified about what's coming next. Television screens all over the country are running an endless loop of the screaming blood guzzlers and piles of rubble left smoking at each family's stronghold. Drops of rain from the overcast grey sky plop heavily onto a discarded copy of the Metro near my feet. Out of the corner of my eye, I catch the word genocide and hastily look away. I'm having a hard enough time keeping my angry darkness damped down as it is. I don't need all these constant reminders. Of course, not all of us are dead. Bombs are indiscriminate. While the majority of the vampires were taken out in one fell swoop, some have been pulled out from the mess. Some were not even present, busy attending to other pressing masses, which even Medici's now vanquished threat couldn't supersede. But those lucky survivors are on their way out. They've been granted asylum by friendly factions in the States and in Europe, and they're in a rush to leave. It doesn't help that there are rumors of death squads taking advantage of the chaos to stalk the streets and settle old feuds by killing any remaining vampires. Whether those rumors are true, it seems that nobody wants to stick around. Nobody apart from me. A black witch, identifiable by his tattooed cheek, trudges towards me. I pull up the collar of my leather jacket and angle my face away. The last thing I need right now is the world knowing where I am, let alone the black witches. It's no secret that I survived. Plenty of voyeuristic Instagrammers and tweeters caught me screaming at O'Shea on my way to the destroyed remains of the Montserrat Mansion. If I had the wherewithal, I'd track down every damn one of them and smash their stupid smartphones into oblivion. But I don't have time for such pettiness. I only slow my steps when the grim facade of the police station comes into view. Weak sunlight, filtering through the heavy clouds, and seemingly undisturbed by the continuous drizzle, bounces off the dirty windows. There was a time when all I could think about was being strong enough to withstand UV rays. Now that I've achieved that milestone, I couldn't give a flying fuck. It makes life easier in terms of getting around, but it doesn't make me happy. Right now, very little could. The police station is busy. I lean against a wall on the opposite side of the street, using the awning above as shelter and a crumpled pack of cigarettes to make it look as if I'm nothing more than a desperate smoker, stopping for a puff. I keep an eye on the door as I cup my hands against the wind and light up. Two humans and an Agathos demon leave the station. Three humans and a white witch enter. They're giving witness statements, I suppose, or stating their worries and seeking police protection. I could tell them that they don't have to be afraid, but they're not my concern. I inhale smoke, filling my lungs and almost choking. It's been a long time, and the taste of nicotine in my mouth is foul. The glowing tip of the cigarette reminds me of the fires flickering across the Montserrat ruins. I scowl and hunch my shoulders. I've just about finished my cigarette when a familiar figure appears, her clothes well-starched and her hair in a severe bun that Miss Jean Brodie herself would envy. She's followed by another detective, who is rather more rumpled. Even from this distance, I can see that they are both tired and drawn, and I wonder how much sleep they've had recently. Then I shrug. At least they'll be getting some overtime. At least their lives haven't been obliterated. Foxworthy and Nichols ignore the police cars parked out front and walk along the pavement. I check my watch. It's only just gone 10. It won't make much difference, though. The Altered Trout, a police hangout, is open 24 hours a day to accommodate all shifts. They'll be planning on having a swift pint before heading home. Unfortunately, not all plans come to fruition. I wait just long enough to confirm their destination, then toss the cigarette butt aside. There's a soft sizzle as it hits the wet pavement. Litterbug that I am, I leave it where it is and walk swiftly to overtake the two police officers. Their heads are bowed in conversation, so neither of them even glance in my direction. I beat the lights and cross the road just ahead of them, push open the pub door and slide inside. Warmth hits me, along with the yeasty smell of beer. I scan the room, spot a recently vacated table in the far corner, and hastily shuffle over. I grab a grubby pint glass with a few dregs left inside as a prop, to make it appear that I'm nothing more than another punter who's been here for hours. Nobody pays me any attention. I let out a silent sigh of relief and hunker down in the seat. My view of the bar is unobstructed. As Foxworthy and Nichols enter, I count the other customers and carefully assess them. There's a bullish-looking man perched on a stool, his arse too large to fit it comfortably. Despite his thick neck and the telltale reddened complexion of an alcoholic, he has that air of law enforcement about him. If it wasn't for the fact that he's wearing comedy socks, barely visible under the hem of his trousers, I'd consider him a threat. Instead, I know that he's the sort who's little more than a bluster, regardless of his rank. A group of younger policemen and women are sitting at another table, occasionally laughing nervously. I frown slightly. It's youth that is dangerous. Youth encourages passion, a willingness to succeed, and a strong sense of right and wrong. It's only when we get older that we tend not to get so passionately involved in every little matter. Experience encourages cynicism, and cynicism encourages apathy. I reckon that, in a pinch, I can take on the group. I can't see any anti-vamp gear on them. I suppose every cloud has a silver lining. There was a rumor that Magix, the vast conglomerate with a stranglehold on the magical market, had recently signed a deal to supply every police force with specially adapted tasers and handcuffs designed to bring down and restrain blood guzzlers. It was one of many signs of changing sentiment towards us. After all, vampires are supposed to be above the law, but Magix seemed to be banking on the law changing. I allow myself a brief smile. All that money they must have spent on research and production, not to mention political lobbying, and now there aren't any vampires to use their equipment on. I return my focus to my target. I don't give a shit about Nichols. She wouldn't help me if I were the last vampire in the world. Foxworthy, however, is a different matter. Relations have become rather strained between us of late, but he did let me hide out in his house a while back. I'd have waited for him there. With his invitation to enter, I can go in whenever I please. But I want him on my side. I won't use the intimidation card unless I absolutely have to. He pays for the drinks, a white wine soda and a pint of ale, and the pair of them find a table out of earshot of everybody else. The younger police officers nod respectfully in their direction, but other than that, they're left alone. I note with amusement that Foxworthy is a wine drinker. The big man doesn't feel the need to look butch, and obviously doesn't care what others think. He takes a delicate sip, his large fingers incongruous around the slender stem of the wine glass. In contrast, Nichols gulps at her ale. A beat later, before I can stand up and head over, Foxworthy stands up again and walks to the loo. Perfect. Without looking at Nichols, I veer around the table and chairs and make a beeline after him. Everyone is focused on themselves, and no one clocks my entry into the gents. The door thuds shut behind me, and I walk up to the urinal next to Foxworthy. Good grief, men's toilets are truly disgusting. He grunts as I approach, no doubt expecting a fellow male. A pale yellow stream of urine is hitting the stained ceramic with perfect aim. But when I murmur a soft hello, he jerks in shock and sends an arc spinning out towards me. I only just manage to jump backwards to avoid it. "Sodding hell!" I exclaim. "Watch it!" He hisses, but together with annoyance, there's something like relief in his eyes. Aw, Foxy. He returns to his ablutions, finishing up before zipping his trousers. Then he turns to me. Wash your hands first, I advise.
You shouldn't be here, Beau.
I cross my arms. I'm serious. Germs can be dangerous.
I don't think I'm the one in danger.
All the same, he turns and goes to the sink.
This isn't the place for you,
he tells me above the sound of the tap.
You know the government is offering safe houses for all remaining blood guzzlers.
I snort. Yeah, they're all heart.
You should take them up on it.
I think of Vince Hale, the slimy politician who worked with Medici to try and gain prominence over us, and worked with Tovra to kill us all. I wouldn't trust anyone in power. Have any vampires taken them up on the offer? Foxworthy dries his hands and doesn't answer.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Do you have numbers? I ask him. Of survivors?
It's not like your lot are beating down our door to tell us they're all right.
I wait. He sighs.
Best guess is around 60, fairly evenly spread across the 5 families. Most of them have already left the country. Some have been killed since the bombs.
I swallow. So those rumors are true. No one would have dared kill a vampire if the families were still around. Foxworthy turns to face me while I struggle to keep a rein on my rage. This isn't the place.
Who was it, really?
He asks. There's no point in playing dumb and pretending I don't know what he's asking. I like that he knows there's more to this than Tovra, a nutty group of fake believers. And there's no point hiding from the truth any longer. The Kakos demons. The only sign that Foxworthy hears me is his sudden blanching. I continue. They were pissed off that the families were growing. They thought we were getting uppity, and decided that the best way to deal with us was to slaughter us like pigs.
Do you have proof?
No. I can get it. What exactly do you need? Foxworthy's jaw clenches as he meets my gaze.
That's why you're here.
It's not a question.
You want us to round up the demons and punish them?
I lift a shoulder. It'll take multiple life sentences of rehabilitation. He exhales.
It's not going to happen.
They're not vampires. They're not above the law. A sad smile traces across his mouth.
You know that doesn't matter.
I can get proof.
It won't make any difference.
He's absolutely right, of course. I knew it before coming here to find him even crossed my mind. All the same, I feel compelled to make my case. The Kakos demons are responsible for thousands of deaths. They're criminals. They could strike anyone else at any time. I tilt my face upwards and lean in. Are you really going to let that hang over the heads of every living person in this country? Foxworthy looks away. We both know that the Kakos demons are too strong. If the entire Metropolitan Police Force went after just one of them, there would be a bloodbath, and the demon would be the one still grinning at the end.
I can pass your allegation on to my superiors, he says finally.
Allegation? Ha! I'm speaking the truth and Foxworthy knows it. He knew it as soon as I opened my mouth. He didn't like it when I was a vigilante. He tenses.
No one should be able to take the law into their own hands.
The Kakos demons have. I respond softly. They've acted as judge, jury, and goddamn executioner. And they're going to get off scot-free because everybody's too bloody scared of them. The flicker in Foxworthy's eyes acknowledges what I'm saying.
Are you asking for permission to go after them, Beau? Because I'm not in a position to give it. And neither will anyone else, no matter what proof you get.
Yeah, I say, bitterness colouring my voice. They've got too much power, and they're too good at what they do.
so all this will be swept under the carpet until the families are nothing more than a footnote in history. Foxworthy runs a hand through his hair. What he doesn't say is that the families are already that. I take off my baseball cap and gaze at him, openly pleading. All I need is the location of one demon. I can't. I hold up my palm. You don't go near him, I say. You don't do anything more than follow the paper trail. Rogue has been trying, but he's got other things to do. Also, this particular demon already knows of his existence, and has taken measures against him. You have access to files which we don't. The demon has a human face, and he works in senior management at Streets of Fire. Well, technically he owns the bloody company, but at this point that's unnecessary information. I hand over a slip of paper with my old address on it, the flat which X had lent me for my own use. This is one of his properties. All I want is another address where he might be located.
You can't go up against a Kakos demon. I know you killed one before, Bo, but you got lucky.
He's referring to X's little game where he pretended to attack me live on television. X permitted me to kill him. It was, like everything X has done, nothing more than a ruse. I didn't actually kill that one. It was set up for the cameras, I say absently. Foxworthy blinks. I dismiss his surprise. And he's the one I'm after. He was with me in front of the Montserrat building, right after it. I swallow, my words disappearing.
He's alive.
I barely manage a nod. If I think too much about X, the darkness inside me begins to take over. I'll do almost anything to see him dead, but I can't give in my baser impulses. Not again. Foxworthy rubs his chin, his rough stubble hinting at how long it's been since he was last home.
There was some vague eyewitness reports of a Kakos demon in the area. I think a team started to look into him, but they were called off onto other matters.
I hiss in irritation. I know the police have to prioritize, but sometimes they can't see the damned wood for the trees. Foxworthy reaches forward and touches my arm.
I'm sorry about Michael Montserrat. I didn't know him personally, but I knew he meant a lot to you.
He doesn't know that Michael's still alive. Doesn't know that he's been turned into a human by X. Every vestige of his vampirism stripped away. I don't tell him. The fewer people who know right now, the better. Michael's safety depends upon it.
Thanks, I say gruffly.
Foxworthy isn't finished.
But you can't do this, Bo. You can't start a vendetta against the Kakos demons. They'll eat you for breakfast. You need to leave London. Get as far away from here as possible. There's nothing left for you now, and it really isn't safe.
I appreciate your concern, I tell him. I mean it. But this is my city, and I'm not leaving. Not for anyone. There's a loud knock on the door, and Nichols' voice drifts through.
You've fallen in, Foxworthy.
You should go.
I nod and reach into my pocket, pulling out a burner phone. Find an address for the demon, I urge. You can contact me with this. His fingers brush against mine as he takes it.
Okay,
he says simply. And I know from the way he looks at me that he will do his very best. It's all I can ask for. I force a smile and step back, letting him go.
One down.
The Agathos court seems much less busy than the police station. It's hardly surprising. I think all but the most urgent of cases have been postponed, given the events of this week. All the same, I'm glad that Harry is actually doing some work for a change. His office building has some stringent anti-vampire security in place, and while I can easily circumnavigate it, I've already threatened the building's owner once before. I have enough people gunning for me. There's no need to add to the tally unnecessarily. I stride in through the plate glass front doors, restored and reinforced since the court was attacked last year. Fortunately, the personnel hasn't changed.
The frowning face of the woman at the front desk is one that I recognize. There's only one person in front of her, an irate Agatho Steeman, who is blithely unconcerned about what's been going on in the city, and who is only worried about his own predicament.
"I demand that my trial goes ahead today," he shrieks. "I've been waiting 6 months. You can't expect me to wait longer just because a bunch of guzzlers have corked it. It's completely unreasonable."
With each word, his voice gets higher and higher. I wince. Extra reinforcement or not, if he manages much more of this, then all that pretty new glass will be shattered again. Meg, the stern receptionist, with eyebrows that have a life of their own, and a personality as charming as a python's, glares at him icily. "Do you see my badge?" she inquires.
"Are you literate? What does it say?"
"I don't give a rat's ass what it says. I..."
She reaches over and slaps him around the face with considerable force. I'm impressed. The demon is stunned into silence.
"I'm a receptionist."
She points again.
"See? Re-cep-tion-ist."
She enunciates each syllable as if the demon in front of her is stupid, which he probably is.
"I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a judge, although you can bet your soul that I'm judging you right now and finding you wanting. I cannot affect court dates. I cannot run trials."
She leans across her desk again and the hapless demon shrinks backwards.
"Now get the hell out of here, before I decide to stop being so nice."
He doesn't need telling twice. Spinning around and almost colliding with me, he hurtles off, skidding on the floor before slamming open the door so that it jutters. He's not completely cowed, however. He glances over his shoulder and throws Meg such a look of hatred that lesser mortals would flinch from. Not her. She reaches calmly under the desk as if she's about to draw out a weapon. The demon drops his gaze and departs abruptly. I clap. Meg's eyes snap to me.
"What do you want?"
"What? Are you going to be mean to me too? I saved your life, Margaret." The expression on her face is one that a sullen teenager would be proud of.
"I don't care."
My eyebrows fly up.
"You don't care that you're alive?" "Don't be ridiculous. I don't care that you saved me. I'm not going to bend the rules just because once upon a time you hauled me out of a burning building."
I stand my ground.
"This burning building."
She shrugs.
"You can't corrupt me. I'm sorry all your pointy-fanged friends are dead."
She doesn't look sorry at all, and I like that she's not changing her tune. She's a woman of conviction, if nothing else.
"But there's not a damn thing I can do about it. If you had any sense, you'd have left London by now."
"I'm here for Harry Dargnaud," I explain.
"He's in court," she snaps. "It's an important case and can't be interrupted. It's one of only three still going ahead today."
I remain patient.
"I know.
I'll wait quietly at the back of the room until he's done." Her malevolence increases. She actually hates me more now for having saved her life. Then I consider the demon who just skedaddled out of here. Maybe she hates just about everyone. She's an equal opportunities kind of person.
"I'll be good. Scouts promise."
She regards me silently before heaving a sigh, as if all this is a great imposition.
"Fine," she says. "Sign in here."
I scribble my name, making sure it's illegible so that it could belong to just about anyone. There's no point in making life easy for anyone who might be tracking me. Then I bow my head respectfully and stroll off in the direction of courtroom number 2. There's a single guard stationed outside. Without glancing at my face, he gestures at me to wait, so I rock back on my heels and try to be good. After a couple of minutes, at some invisible signal, he steps aside and lets me to enter. Frankly, I think he just wants to look important. Pleased that part is over, I head inside. There are plenty of empty seats. Most people are choosing to stay home this week, and even the usual court tourists are absent.
I sit towards the back and then I wait. Back in my PI days, I spent a fair bit of time in courtrooms. It's not as exciting as it sounds. Usually there's just a lot of hanging around. Plus the legalese, which I'm sure is designed to be incomprehensible, makes the proceedings seem far longer than they need to be. I have a reasonable respect for the legal system, both Agathos and human. But surely they could spice things up sometimes. A few good men this is not. Dagno is at the front, head bowed as he pretends to take copious notes. The barrister for the prosecution appears equally bored. I'm not surprised. There's a witchy witness with astonishingly frizzy hair, droning on about accounts up at the front. Less than a minute in, and I already want to shoot myself in the head. The defendant seems to be a youngish demon wearing a sharp suit. It's difficult to tell for sure, as I can only see the back of his head. I recognize the tailoring, however. I've not spent years hanging around my grandfather for nothing. Whoever this character is, he has a fair bit of money. He's wearing Savile Row's finest, but despite his apparent wealth and his proud posture, the tips of his pointed ears are flushed red. He's as guilty as sin. My own ears prickle, and I realize that the judge's attention has been diverted from the proceedings. He's noticed me sitting quietly, and is gaping at me as if he's never seen a vampire before. He swallows hard, his Adam's apple bobbing in his throat. Then he starts to tug at his collar and twitch. I give him a little wave in return. It does just what I hope, and makes him even more uncomfortable. "So, as you can tell from the dividends arrived at through calculation of Mr. Aaron's assets, the taxation requirements are substantially..." The judge coughs.
"Let's take a break."
Everyone jerks in surprise. Dagno's head turns, his eyes suspicious. But comprehension dawns when he catches sight of me. He immediately stands.
"Excellent idea, Your Honour."
The guilt-ridden Mr. Aaron isn't particularly thrilled. He tugs at Dagno's sleeve. The lawyer soothes him expertly. I slip back out again. When Dagno emerges, he jerks his head to the right. I nod imperceptibly and follow. For once, he's being discreet. Who knew he was capable of such a thing? I suppose it's testament to just how dire the situation is. I run my tongue across my teeth, pausing at each fang. The feeling is strangely comforting. Dagno opens a door and gestures inside, but I wait for him to enter first. I want him in front of me and visible at all times. As soon as the door closes behind us, he stretches out his arms and envelops me in a hug. He squeezes tightly.
"I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry."
I wait until he's done and then step back. "I thought only important trials were running today," I say, to avoid hearing any more sympathy. Platitudes don't make me feel any better. He frowns.
"Oh, you mean the Aaron thing?"
He waves a hand dismissively.
"There's not much the government takes more seriously than tax evasion."
"Unless," I say expressionlessly, "they're the ones evading tax." He looks blank for a moment, then laughs. It sounds forced.
"Oh, they take avoiding their own tax quite seriously, too."
He pauses.
"Has Michael's body been found yet?"
I tell a version of the truth. "No." Dagno's lips tighten. I can almost imagine he cares. I examine him more closely. There are heavy shadows under his eyes, and his hair isn't as perfectly coiffured as usual. He looks almost as haggard as Foxworthy. I have a sudden flash of insight. "You've lost a lot of clients, haven't you?" He winces.
"Yes."
His nose wrinkles and he balls up his fists.
"Just as I was getting somewhere. No human lawyer had ever gotten so close to a family as I did. I was earning respect, and I was gaining their trust. And now..."
He exhales heavily.
"Now all that's gone to shit."
He glares at me.
"Before you castigate me for thinking only of myself and money, a lot of people at my firm are going to lose their jobs because of what's happened.
It's early days. The families might regroup yet."
Dagno snorts.
You and I both know it's too late for that.
He lifts his chin.
They're saying it's this religious group, Tovra.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?